The slave district at the very edge of the salt marsh was staggering in its misery. People lived alongside turkey buzzards and pigs in mud huts with roofs of palm, and children drank from the swamp in the streets. But with its intense colors and radiant voices, it was the liveliest district, and even more so at twilight, when the residents carried chairs into the middle of the street to enjoy the cool air. The priest distributed the pastries among the children of the marsh and kept three for his supper. The temple was a mud and cane shack with a roof of bitter palm and a wooden cross on its ridge. It had rough plank benches, a single altar with a single saint, and a wooden pulpit where Father Aquino preached on Sundays in African languages. The parish house was an extension of the church behind the altar, where the priest lived in austere conditions on one room that had a cot and a crude chair. In the rear was a small rocky courtyard and an arbour with clusters of blighted grapes and a fence of thorn bushes that separated the courtyard from the marsh. The only drinking water was in a mortar cistern in one corner of the yard. An old sacristan and an orphan girl of 14, both converted Mandingos, assisted him in the church and in the house, but were not needed after the rosary. Before he closed the door, the priest ate the three pastries with a glass of water, and then, with his habitual formula in Castilian, he took his leave of the neighbors sitting in the street. "May God grant all of you a blessed good night." At 4 in the morning, the sacristan, who lived a block away from the church, began to ring the bell for Mass. Before 5 o'clock, in view of the fact that the priest was late, the sacristan looked for him in his room. He was not there or in the courtyard. He continued to look for him in the vicinity of the church because he sometimes visited nearby courtyards very early in the day to talk to the neighbors. He told the few parishioners who came to the church that there would be no Mass because the priest was nowhere to be found. At 8 o'clock, with the sun already hot, the servant girl went to the cistern for water, and there was Father Aquino, floating on his back, wearing the breeches he kept on when he slept. It was a sad, widely mourned death, and a mystery that was never solved, which the abbess proclaimed as definitive proof of demonic animosity toward her convent. The news did not reach the cell of Sierva Maria, who waited for Father Aquino with innocent hopefulness. She could not explain to Cayetano who he was, but she did convey her gratitude for the return of the necklaces and his promise to rescue her. Until that moment, it had seemed to both of them that love was enough to make them happy. In her disenchantment with Father Aquino, it was Sierva Maria who realized that their freedom depended only on themselves. Late one night, after long hours of kisses, she pleaded with De Laura not to go. He did not think she was serious, and said goodbye with one more kiss. She leaped from the bed and stretched her arms across the door. "Either you stay or I'm going with you." She had once told Cayetano that she would like to take refuge with him in San Basilio de Palenque, a settlement of fugitive slaves 12 leagues from here, where she was sure to be received like a queen. It seemed a providential idea to Cayetano, but he did not connect it to their escape. He put his trust instead in legal formalities. In the Marquis recovering his daughter with undeniable proof that she was not possessed, and in his obtaining the bishop's pardon and permission to join a lay community where marriage of a priest or nun would be so common that it would shock no one. And so when Sierva Maria forced him to choose between staying or taking her with him, De Laura tried once again to distract her. She clung to his neck and threatened to scream. Dawn was breaking. Affrighted, De Laura managed to break away with a shove and fled just as they were beginning to sing matins. Sierva Maria's reaction was ferocious. She scratched the warder's face at the most trivial provocation, locked herself in with the crossbar, and threatened to burn the cell and herself inside it if they did not let her go. The warder, enraged because of her bloodied face, shouted, "Just you dare, you beast of Beelzebub!" Sierva Maria's only reply was to set fire to the mattress with the sanctuary lamp. The intervention of Martina and her soothing ways prevented a tragedy. In any event, in her daily report, the warder requested that the girl be transferred to a more secure cell in the cloistered pavilion. Sierra Maria's urgency heightened Cayetano's own longing to find an immediate solution other than flight. On two occasions he attempted to see the Marquis, and both times he was stopped by the mastiffs, out of their cages and roaming free in the house with no master. The truth was that the Marquis would never live there again. Conquered by his interminable fears, he had tried to seek refuge in the shelter of Dulce Olivia, but she did not open her door to him. Ever since the onset of his solitary grief, he had called on her by every means at his disposal, and had received nothing but mocking responses on little paper birds. Then, without warning, she appeared, unsummoned and unannounced. She had swept and cleaned the kitchen, in a shambles through lack of use, and on the stove a pot bubbled over a cheerful flame. She was dressed for Sunday in organza flounces, and brightened by the latest cosmetics and ointments, and the only sign of her madness was a hat with an enormous brim trimmed in fabric fish and birds. "I thank you for coming," said the Marquis. "I was feeling very lonely," and he concluded with a lament. "I have lost Sierra."
"It's your fault," she said in an offhand way. "You did everything you could to lose her."
Their supper was a stew in the local style, using three kinds of meat and the best of the vegetable garden. Dulce Olivia served it as if she were the mistress of the house, with manners well suited to her costume. The fierce dogs followed her everywhere, panting and winding themselves around her legs, and she beguiled them with the murmurings of a bride. She sat across the table from the Marquis, just as they might have been when they were young and not afraid of love, and they ate in silence without looking at each other, dripping with perspiration and eating their soup with an old married couple's lack of interest. After the first course, Dulce Olivia paused to sigh and became aware of her age.
"This is how we could have been," she said.
The Marquis found her bravado contagious. He looked at her. She was fat and old, two teeth were missing, and her eyes were withered. This is how they could have been, perhaps, if he had found the courage to oppose his father.
"When you were like this, you seemed to be in your right mind," he said. "I always have been," she said. "It was you who never saw me as I really was.
I picked you out of the crowd when you were all young and beautiful, and it was difficult to choose the best," he said.
"I picked myself out for you," she said. "Not you. You were always what you are now, a miserable devil."
"You insult me in my own house," he said.
The brewing argument excited Dulce Olivia. "It's as much mine as yours," she said, "as the girl is mine, even though a bitch whelped her." And not giving him time to reply, she concluded, "And worst of all are the evil hands you've left her in."
"She is in the hands of God," he said.
Dulce Olivia shrieked in fury. "She is in the hands of the bishop's son who had made her into his pregnant whore."
"If you bit your tongue, you would poison yourself," shouted the Marquis, appalled.
"Sir Gunther exaggerates, but she doesn't lie," said Dulce Olivia. "And don't try to humiliate me because I'm the only one you have left to powder your face when you die."
It was the invariable finale. Her tears began to fall onto her plate like drops of soup. The dogs were asleep, but the tension of the quarrel woke them, and they raised their watchful heads and growled deep in their throats. The Marquis felt as if he did not have enough air.
"You see," he said in a rage, "this is how we would have been."
She stood without finishing her meal. She cleared the table, washed the dishes and casseroles with sordid fury, and as she washed each one, she smashed it against the basin. He let her cry until she threw the pieces of crockery like an avalanche of hail into the trash bin. She left without saying goodbye. The Marquis never knew, and no one else ever knew, just when Dulce Olivia had stopped being herself and become no more than a nocturnal apparition in the house. The fiction that Cayetano de Laura was the bishop's son had replaced the older rumor that they had been lovers ever since Salamanca. Dulce Olivia's version,
confirmed and distorted by Sukunta, said in effect that Sierva Maria, sequestered in the convent to satiate the satanic appetites of Cayetano de Laura, had conceived a child with two heads. Their saturnalias, Sagunta said, had contaminated the entire community of Clarissans. The Marquis never recovered. Stumbling through the quagmire of the past, he searched for a refuge against his terror and found only the image of Bernarda, ennobled by his solitude. He tried to conjure it away by recalling the things he hated most about her. Her fetid gases, her ill-tempered remarks, her bunions as sharp as rooster's claws. And the more he tried to vilify her, the more idealized her recollections became. Defeated by nostalgia, he sent exploratory messages to the sugar plantation at Mahates, where he supposed that she had gone when she left the house, and she was there. He sent word that she should forget her anger and come home, so they might at least each have someone to die with. He received no reply and went to see her. He had to find his way back along the streams of memory. The estate that had been the best in the vice-regency was reduced to nothing. It was impossible to distinguish the road from the undergrowth. All that remained of the mill was rubble, machinery eaten away by rust, the skeletons of the last two oxen still yoked to the wheel. The pool of sighs in the shade of the calabash trees was the only thing that seemed alive. Before he could see the house through the burned brambles of the canebrakes, the Marquis smelled the scent of Bernarda's soaps, which had become her natural odor, and he realized how much he longed to be with her. And there she was, sitting in a rocking chair on the front veranda and eating cacao, her unmoving eyes fixed on the horizon. She wore a tunic of rose-colored cotton, and her hair was still damp from a recent bath in the pool of sighs. The Marquis greeted her before climbing the three stairs to the gallery. "Good afternoon," Bernarda replied without looking at him, as if it were no one's greeting. The Marquis went up to the veranda, and from there he looked out over the brambles and searched the entire horizon in a single, uninterrupted glance. For as far as he could see, there was nothing but wild brush and the calabash trees at the pool.
"Where are all the people?" he asked.
Bernarda, like her father, answered a second time without looking at him. "They all left," she said. "There's not a living soul for 100 leagues around." He went inside to find a chair. The house was in ruins, and plants with small purple flowers were breaking through the bricks on the floor. In the dining room he saw the old table, the same chairs devoured by termites, the clock that had been stopped at the same hour for longer than anyone could remember, all of it in an air filled with invisible dust that he could feel with each breath. The Marquis carried out one of the chairs, sat down next to Bernarda, and said in a very quiet voice, "I have come for you." Bernarda's expression did not change, but she nodded her head in almost imperceptible affirmation. He described his life, the solitary house, the slaves crouching behind the hedges with their knives at the ready, the interminable nights. "That is not living," he said. "It never was," she said. "Perhaps it could be," he said. "You wouldn't say that to me if you really knew how much I hate you," she said. "I have always thought I hated you too," he said. "But now it seems I am not so certain." Then Bernarda opened her heart so that he could see what was there in the light of day. She told him how her father had sent her to him, using the pretext of herrings and pickles, how they had deceived him with the old ruse of reading his palm, how they had decided she would violate him when he played the innocent, and how they had planned the cold, certain move of conceiving Sierva Maria and trapping him for life. The only thing he had to thank her for was that she did not have the heart to take the final step planned with her father, which was to pour laudanum in his soup so that they would not have to suffer his presence. "I put the noose around my own neck," she said. "But I'm not sorry. It was too much to expect that on top of everything else I'd have to love that poor premature creature, or you when you've been the cause of my misfortunes. But the final step in her degradation had been the loss of Judas Iscariote. Searching for him in other men, she had given herself over to unrestrained fornication with the slaves on the plantation, something she had always thought repugnant before daring it for the first time. She chose them in crews and dispatched them one by one on the paths between the cane brakes until the fermented honey and cacao tablets shattered her beauty and she became swollen and ugly, and they did not have the courage to take on so much body. Then she began to pay. At first with trinkets for the younger ones, according to their looks and size, and in the end with pure gold for anyone she could find. By the time she discovered that they were fleeing in droves to San Basilio de Palenque to escape her insatiable craving, it was too late. Then I learned that I would have been capable of hacking them to pieces with a machete, she said, not shedding a tear. And not only them, but you and the girl, and my skinflint of a father and everyone else who turned my life to shit. But I was no longer in any condition to kill anybody. They sat in silence, watching night fall over the brambles. A flock of distant animals could be heard on the horizon, and a woman's inconsolable voice calling them by name, one by one, until it was dark. The Marquis sighed. I see now that I have nothing to thank you for. He stood without haste, put the chair back in its place, and left the way he had come, not saying goodbye, and not carrying a light. All that remained of him, a skeleton eaten away by turkey buzzards, was found 2 summers later on a path leading nowhere. Martina Laborde had spent that entire morning embroidering in order to finish a piece that had taken longer than expected. She had her midday meal in Sierra Maria's cell, and then went to her own cell for a siesta. In the afternoon, as she was finishing the last stitches, she spoke to the girl with unusual sadness. If you ever leave this prison, or if I leave first, always remember me, she said. It will be my only glory. Sierra Maria did not understand until the following day, when she was awakened by the warder shouting that Martina was not in her cell. They searched every corner of the convent and could not find a trace of her except for a note, written in her flowery hand, which Sierra Maria discovered under her pillow. I will pray 3 times a day that the two of you will be very happy. She was still overwhelmed by surprise when the abbess came in with the vicar and the other reverend sisters of her infantry, and a squad of guards armed with muskets. She stretched out a choleric hand to strike Sierra Maria and shouted, "You are an accomplice, and you will be punished!" The girl raised her free hand with a determination that stopped the abbess in her tracks. "I saw them leave," she said. The abbess was stunned. She was not alone. "There were 6 of them," said Sierra Maria. It did not seem possible, and even less so, that they could leave by the terrace whose only point of egress was the fortified courtyard. "They had bat's wings," said Sierra Maria, flapping her arms. "They spread them on the terrace, and then they carried her away, flying, flying to the other side of the ocean." The captain of the patrol crossed himself in fear and fell to his knees. "Hail Mary, most pure," he said. "Conceived without sin," they all said in a chorus. It was a perfect escape, planned by Martina in absolute secrecy and down to the smallest detail, ever since she had discovered that Cayetano was spending his nights in the convent. The only thing she did not foresee, or did not care about, was the need to close the sewer entrance from the inside to avoid arousing suspicion. Those who investigated the escape found the tunnel open, explored it, learned the truth, and sealed both ends without delay. Sierra Maria was forced to move to a locked cell in the pavilion of those interred in life. That night, beneath a splendid moon, Cayetano tore his hands trying to break through the seal on the tunnel. Driven by a demented force, he ran to find the Marquis. He pushed open the main door without knocking and entered the deserted house, whose interior light was the same as the light in the street, for the brilliant moon made the whitewashed walls seem transparent. Clean and neat, the furnishings in place, flowers in the urns, everything was perfect in the abandoned house. The groan of the hinges aroused the mastiffs, but Dulce Olivia silenced them with a martial command. Cayetano saw her in the green shadows of the courtyard, beautiful, phosphorescent, wearing the tunic of a marquesa, her hair adorned by fresh camellias with a frenzied scent, and he raised his hand to form a cross with his index finger and thumb. "In the name of God, who are you?" he asked. "A soul in torment," she said. "And you?" "I am Cayetano de Laura," he said, "and I have come on bended knee to beg the Signor Marquis to listen to me for a moment." Dulce Olivia's eyes flashed in anger. "The Signor Marquis is not interested in listening to a scoundrel," she said. "And who are you to speak with so much command?" "I am the queen of this house," she said. "For the love of God," said de Laura, "tell the Marquis that I have come to talk to him about his daughter." And with his hand on his heart, he came straight to the point and said, "I am dying of love for her." "One more word and I will turn loose the dogs," said Dulce Olivia in indignation and pointed to the door. "Get out of here." The power of her authority was so great that Cayetano backed out of the house in order not to lose sight of her. On Tuesday, when Abrenuncio entered his cubicle at the hospital, he found de Laura devastated by mortal vigils. He told the doctor about everything, from the real reasons for his punishment to his nights of love in the cell. Abrenuncio was perplexed. "I would have imagined anything about you except these extremes of lunacy," Cayetano, bewildered in turn, asked. "Have you never gone through this?" "Never, my son," said Abrenuncio. "Sex is a talent, and I do not have it." Abrenuncio tried to dissuade him. He said that love was an emotion contra natura that condemned two strangers to a base and unhealthy dependence, and the more intense it was, the more ephemeral. But Cayetano did not hear him. He was obsessed with fleeing as far as possible from the oppression of the Christian world. "Only the Marquis can help us with regard to the law," he said. "I wanted to get down on my knees and plead with him, but I did not find him at home." "You never will," said Abrenuncio. "He heard rumors that you attempted to abuse the girl, and now I see that from a Christian's point of view he was not mistaken." He looked into Cayetano's eyes. "Aren't you afraid you will be damned?" "I believe I already am, but not by the Holy Spirit," said de Laura without alarm. "I have always believed he attributes more importance to love than to faith." Abrenuncio could not hide the wonder caused in him by this man so recently freed from the shackles of reason. But he made no false promises, above all when the holy office loomed. "You people have a religion of death that fills you with the joy and courage to confront it," he said. "I do not. I believe the only essential thing is to be alive." Cayetano raced to the convent. In the light of day, he walked through the service door and crossed the garden, taking no precautions, convinced he had been made invisible through the power of prayer. He climbed to the second floor, walked down a solitary corridor with low ceilings that connected the two sections of the convent, and entered the silent, rarefied world of those interred in life. Without realizing it, he had walked past the new cell where Sierra Maria wept for him. He had almost reached the prison pavilion when a shout at his back stopped him. "Halt!" He turned and saw a nun with a veil covering her face and a crucifix held high against him. He took a step toward her, but the nun placed Christ between them. "Vade retro!" she shouted. He heard another voice behind him. "Vade retro!" And then another and another. "Vade retro!" and he turned around several times and realized he was in the middle of a circle of phantasmagoric nuns with veiled faces who brandished their crucifixes and pursued him with their cries, "Vade retro, Satana!" Cayetano reached the end of his strength. He was handed over to the Holy Office and condemned at a public trial that cast suspicions of heresy over him and provoked disturbances among the populace and controversies in the bosom of the church. Through a special act of grace, he served his sentence as a nurse at the Amor de Dios Hospital, where he lived many years with his patients, eating and sleeping with them on the ground, and washing in their troughs with water they had used, but never achieving his confessed desire to contract leprosy. Sierva Maria waited for him in vain. After 3 days, she stopped eating in an explosion of rebelliousness that exacerbated the signs of her possession. Shattered by the downfall of Cayetano, by the indecipherable death of Father Aquino, by the public resonance of a misfortune that went beyond his wisdom and his power, the bishop resumed the exorcism with an energy that was inconceivable, given his condition and his age. This time, Sierva Maria, confined in a straitjacket, her skull shaved by a razor, confronted him with satanic ferocity, speaking in tongues or with the shrieks of infernal birds. On the second day, the immense bellowing of maddened cattle could be heard, the earth trembled, and it was no longer possible to think that Sierva Maria was not at the mercy of all the demons of hell. When she returned to her cell, she was given an enema of holy water, which was the French method for expelling any devils that might remain in her belly. The struggle continued for 3 more days. Although she had not eaten for a week, Sierva Maria managed to extricate one leg and kick her heel into the bishop's lower abdomen, knocking him to the ground. Only then did they realize she'd been able to free herself because her body was so emaciated that the straps no longer confined her. The ensuing outrage made it advisable to interrupt the exorcism, an action favored by the ecclesiastical council, but opposed by the bishop. Sierva Maria never knew what became of Cayetano de Laura, why he never returned with his basket of delicacies from the arcades and his insatiable nights. On the 29th of May, having lost her will to endure any more, she dreamed again of the window looking out on a snow-covered field from which Cayetano de Laura was absent and to which he would never return. In her lap she held a cluster of golden grapes that grew back as soon as she ate them. But this time she did not pull them off one by one, but two by two, hardly breathing in her longing to strip the cluster of its last grape. The warder who came in to prepare her for the 6th session of exorcism found her dead of love in her bed, her eyes radiant and her skin like that of a newborn baby. Strands of hair gushed like bubbles as they grew back on her shaved head.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.